Wake up, and welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. For hundreds of years, poets have composed aubades. These are lyrics announcing the arrival of dawn all too soon for lovers who want the night to be prolonged. Romeo and Juliet together form an aubade duet at dawn after their only night together. He knows he must flee immediately so he does not get arrested. She wants him to linger, not to be so tense. They playfully argue whether they hear the nightingale, as Juliet claims, or the lark announcing dawn, as Romeo insists. Neither knows their only night together has just come to an end. Shakespeare's near contemporary, John Donne, wrote a poem called The Sun Rising, in which a man in bed with a woman scolds the sun for intruding on them. Quotes, "Busy old fool, unruly sun, why dost thou thus through windows and through curtains call on us? Must to thy motions lovers' seasons run?" He urges the sun to go bother schoolboys and apprentices, hunters and farmers, but leave him and his lover alone. Their primary world of intimacy is more important than anybody else's work. Donne's male speaker is extravagant. He boasts he could block out the sun with a wink, but he won't do that, because then he would lose sight of the woman next to him. He complains at length as he realizes he must return to his everyday routines. The night is over, the joy ended, and he knows he must at least pretend to be productive out of bed, resuming his daily tasks. We don't hear the woman speak. We may imagine she's either flattered or at least amused by his articulate complaint that the sun forces them to separate from one another. Well, Shakespeare and John Donne helped establish some of the conventions of aubades. With today's episode of Poems for Company, we leap to the 20th century and listen to some modern aubades that take liberties with the genre. Let's enter a Dublin bedroom, where a woman contemplates how indifferent the dawn and the sunrise are to the jackdaws outside her window. Jackdaws are related to crows, but a bit smaller. The dawn and the sunrise are also indifferent to the shorebirds just miles away from her Dublin home. Then she slowly shifts to her own circumstance as a parent with obligations that are about to commence. Like Romeo, like Donne's speaker, there's a definite sense this woman realizes she has no control over time. Duty calls. This is the Irish poet Nuala Ní Donnell's simply titled aubade. It's all the same to morning what it dawns on the bickering of jackdaws in leafy trees, on that dandy from the wetlands, the green mallard's stylish glissando among reeds, on the moorhen whose white petticoat flickers around the bog hole, on the oyster catcher on tiptoe at low tide. It's all the same to the sun what it rises on the windows in houses in Georgian squares, on bees swarming to blitz suburban gardens, on young couples yawning in unison before they do it again, on dew like sweat or tears on lilies and roses, on your bare shoulders. But it isn't all the same to us that nighttime runs out, that we must make do with today's happenings and stoop and somehow glue together the silly little shards of our lives so that our children can drink water from broken bowls, not from cupped hands. It isn't the same at all. Nulla ne donals obed. We have to wait until the 12th of 18 lines before the speaker acknowledges she's not alone with her reference to your bare shoulder, and then she refers to us, that is, herself and her partner. The poem opens with an account of the birds, first the local jackdaw, and then we view through a wide-angle lens the shoreline not far away from the Dublin neighborhood of Georgian homes where the speaker lives. We see and hear these birds. Projecting human traits onto the jackdaws, she accuses them of bickering. The male mallard, the drake with its green head, is a dandy, knows it's good-looking, and its signature sound is a stylish glissando. In music, that's a glide from one pitch to another, like a pianist sliding his fingernails up or down the keyboard, or when an organ player uses the side of the hand to sweep across the keys quickly. Glissando. We definitely hear it. The glissando wakes us up. Moorhens are mostly brown or black birds with some white plumage, dumpy and compact. Nulla ne donals moorhen does not sound to me like it's dumpy. Its white petticoat flickers around the bog hole. At low tide, the oyster catcher's on tiptoes. I've read that nearly all species of oyster catchers are monogamous. I won't read too much into that fact in regard to the speaker of this poem. She gives not a hint of a whiff of suggestion that she's happy or unhappy with her mate. She's definitely not writing an editorial urging us to agree with her about coupledom or parenthood. Instead, the final stanza implies she is resigned to her situation of the endless responsibility of parenting, which itself is merely mentioned, not at all detailed. In the final stanza, she complains. She's annoyed she has to get out of bed. Is that because the night of lovemaking has been so splendid? Or because she has to snap to attention and play her parental role? And maybe I'm wrong to even speculate that a night of splendid lovemaking occurred. Maybe she just did not get enough sleep. This 18-line poem consists of just 4 sentences. The first 3 unfurl with semicolons and commas. This is a 3-stanza poem. The first and second stanza consist of 1 sentence each. The 3rd stanza is all 1 sentence for the first 5.5 lines. But then, with the final sentence, the poem snaps shut. It isn't the same at all. After asserting that it's all the same to morning what it dawns on, and it's all the same to the sun what it rises on, the ache of that final line stands out. It's just not the same for the couple. Again, let's hear Ní Donal's Obed. It's all the same to morning what it dawns on the bickering of jackdaws in leafy trees, on that dandy from the wetlands, the green mallard's stylish glissando among reeds, on the moorhen whose white petticoat flickers around the bog hole, on the oyster catcher on tiptoe at low tide. It's all the same to the sun what it rises on the windows in houses in Georgian squares, on bees swarming to blitz suburban gardens, on young couples yawning in unison before they do it again, on dew like sweat or tears on lilies and roses, on your bare shoulders. But it isn't all the same to us that nighttime runs out, that we must make do with today's happenings and stoop and somehow glue together the silly little shards of our lives so that our children can drink water from broken bowls, not from cupped hands. It isn't the same at all. I did not read the version the poet herself wrote. Nuala Ní Donnell writes in Gaelic, and the translator for this Aubade is the late Northern Irish poet Michael Longley. In fact, in the volume where this poem appears, titled Pharaoh's Daughter, all of Ní Donnell's poems are translated into English by other Irish poets, 13 in all. In another poem, in this same volume, she offers a metaphor to justify her choice to write in a language that I have no doubt sounds lovely, but is not standard currency in her country. In her poem, The Language Issue, she says, "I place my hope on the water in this little boat of the language, the way an infant might be placed in a homemade vessel, pushed down a river where perhaps it may arrive in the lap of some pharaoh's daughter. And then, like Moses himself, eventually gain the full attention of everybody." But back to our Aubades. Nuala Ní Donnell's Aubade was published in 1990. Philip Larkin's Aubade landed a bit earlier, 1977. And Larkin's variation on the genre stands out. For one, the speaker is alone, defying the conventional circumstance. Furthermore, his focus is death, his own, how thoughts of his demise shadow him at any time during the day, but especially demand his attention in the dawn hours. He wakes at 4 and conducts what he calls an arid interrogation. That is, he's not promising us any breakthroughs of insight. He knows his thoughts are neither fruitful nor productive. His arid interrogation continues through the pre-dawn until the sky outside his window lightens. I don't think any words in this poem will drive us to the dictionary. Well, he does refer to species stuff, meaning showy language that might appeal, though it's deceiving. That may be as challenging as the vocabulary gets. Occasionally, his phrasing may give us pause. So, after I read it, we will pause and look back at some of his phrasing. This is Philip Larkin's Aubade. I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time, the curtain edges will grow light. Till then, I see what's really always there. Unresting death, a whole day near now, making all thought impossible. But how, and where, and when I shall myself die? Arid interrogation. Yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify. The mind blanks at the glare, not in remorse, the good not done, the love not given, time torn off unused, nor wretchedly, because an only life can take so long to climb clear of its wrong beginnings, and may never, but at the total emptiness forever, the sure extinction that we travel to and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. This is a special way of being afraid no trick dispels. Religion used to try, that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die, and specious stuff that says, no rational being can fear a thing it will not feel, not seeing that this is what we fear, no sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell, nothing to think with, nothing to love or link with, the anesthetic from which none come round. And so, it stays just on the edge of vision, a small, unfocused blur, a standing chill that slows each impulse down to indecision. Most things may never happen. This one will. And realization of it rages out in furnace fear when we are caught without people or drink. Courage is no good. It means not scaring others. Being brave lets no one off the grave. Death is no different whined at than withstood. Slowly, light strengthens, and the room takes shape. It stands plain as a wardrobe. What we know, have always known, know that we can't escape, yet can't accept. One side will have to go. Meanwhile, telephones crouch, getting ready to ring in locked-up offices, and all the uncaring, intricate, rented world begins to rouse. The sky is white as clay, with no sun. Work has to be done. Postmen, like doctors, go from house to house. Philip Larkin's Obed. The speaker defies any claim that he's a valuable member of his society. In the day, he works, and at night, he gets half drunk. He does not suggest what his work might be, or if he thinks it's important in any way. There's neither joy nor redemption in his work. He fails to mention any family or any loved ones. He's on his own with his arid interrogation. When he contemplates his impending death, he's disturbed, but not because he feels remorse over his actions when younger. He admits that what wakes him up are not thoughts and kind actions he could have carried out, or love that he might have offered. He's not pulled out of his sleep because of time he's wasted. Instead, he's pulled out of sleep to contemplate the fact he's now one day closer to entering a zone of nothingness. The sure extinction that we travel to and shall be lost in always. He foresees he will be emotionally and intellectually blank for eternity. Religion is of no help to counter these fears. He says it's a vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die. That's complex. Music is like a brocade, a heavy fabric with raised designs. But it's also moth-eaten, suggesting outdated. A vast moth-eaten musical brocade. Why musical? Perhaps Larkin intends to suggest the emotional appeal of hymns and other church songs, attempts at religious consolations, appeals he dismisses as flimsy. Religion does not otherwise enter this poem. Not only does he ignore, and so deny, immortality in a potential afterlife, he also refuses to suggest that some divine power will take a personal interest in him. That possibility seems too irrational to consider at all. At the poem's end, when daylight does arrive, he says, "The sky is white as clay, with no sun." The emotional bleakness prevails. "Work has to be done," the penultimate line declares, a faint echo of the parent speaking in our other Irish obeid. When we arrive at that final stanza, we might detect a tone of self-congratulation. The speaker wants us to know he has just shared with us what we all recognize, but many of us are unwilling to face. It may be we can't accept what he just told us, but can we escape the pre-dawn ruminations he shared with us? Can we contradict him? There are 5 stanzas in Larkin's Obeid. Each stanza consists of 10 lines, and he follows a specific rhyme pattern throughout. It's subtle, but you may be able to hear it. The 9th line of each 10-line stanza is the shortest, so he offers to us his pre-dawn ruminations in a careful form. Again, this is Philip Larkin's Obeid. I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time, the curtain edges will grow light. Till then, I see what's really always there. Unresting death, a whole day nearer now, making all thought impossible but how and where and when I shall myself die. Arid interrogation, yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify. The mind blanks at the glare, not in remorse, the good not done, the love not given, time torn off unused, nor wretchedly, because an only life can take so long to climb clear of its wrong beginnings, and may never. But at the total emptiness forever, the sure extinction that we travel to and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. This is a special way of being afraid. No trick dispels. religion used to try, that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die, and specious stuff that says no rational being can fear a thing it will not feel, not seeing that this is what we fear. No sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell, nothing to think with, nothing to love or link with, the anesthetic from which none come round. And so it stays just on the edge of vision, a small, unfocused blur, a standing chill that slows each impulse down to indecision. Most things may never happen. This one will. And realization of it rages out in furnace fear when we are caught without people or drink. Courage is no good. It means not scaring others. Being brave lets no one off the grave. Death is no different whined at than withstood. Slowly light strengthens, and the room takes shape. It stands plain as a wardrobe. What we know, have always known, know that we can't escape, yet can't accept. One side will have to go. Meanwhile, telephones crouch, getting ready to ring in locked-up offices, and all the uncaring, intricate, rented world begins to rouse. The sky is white as clay, with no sun. Work has to be done. Postmen, like doctors, go from house to house. Maybe in my next episode I will make more of an effort to cheer you up, but let's recognize how wonderfully varied the Abed form may be. From a boastful lover in Donne's poem, "Busy old fool, unruly son, why dost thou thus through windows and through curtains call on us? Must to thy motions lover's seasons run?" To a wary parent in Ní Donal's Abed, "We must stoop and somehow glue together the silly shards of our lives." To an isolated, aging speaker in Larkin's version, "Courage is no good, it means not scaring others." All episodes of Poems for Company may be heard online at kmun.org or with your favorite app. Our theme music is Philip Auberg's Going to the Sun from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company, and many thanks if you are a contributor to KMUN, which provides the recording studio, technical support, and airtime for this show.